Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now, we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is another mystery case. But this time, instead of the second most handsome doctor in North America, we have the third most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Derek Miles. He's the head of the Barbell Medicine Pain and Rehab Division, the founder of Cooking with Adhesions. He's a doctor of physical therapy, and he's the strongest butcher in Ohio. Dr. Derek Miles, what's going on, man?
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I don't think I've earned half of those titles, but I will happily take the props.
Well, you are definitely the head of the Barbell Medicine's Pain and Rehab Division, and you are definitely the founder of Cooking with Adhesions. I've seen nobody else try to commandeer your titles, so.
Well, I'm still waiting for the Powerlifting Federation meet where the only requirement is having butchered an animal.
And you that's know, what I'm saying. Yeah, there's no like if you go to openpowerlifting.com, you can like refine the records by like virtually, you know, infinite amount of things. It could be like, okay, age division, weight division, knee wraps, knee sleeves, deadlift, like whatever. You can keep going. They just need like a drop down box for like has butchered an animal. And then in which case you would be the record holder across the board.
As far as we know so far.
As far as we know, yeah. Yeah, well, that's how I typically like to do. I like to just make bold claims and then disappear into the ether, you know, like Homer back into the bushes, and then wait for somebody to be like, actually, you didn't know about this specific person who, you know, did a meet in Prague in the 80s. So I'm like, well, now I know. So if you're just tuning in, this is your first Barbell Medicine Podcast, welcome. These mystery cases are exactly as the name leads on. I present a real medical case, in this case to Dr. Derek Miles, and he's got to figure out not only what's wrong with the individual, but why it happened. And then we discuss some clinical pearls at the end. So usually some practical takeaways, some strategies, and other information that you might find useful. There may be a little drama added to the case presentation for edutainment purposes, but I try to keep it as close as possible to the actual published case report, which I've linked in the show notes below if you actually want to read it. So as is my custom, I have to predict whether or not you're going to successfully identify the diagnosis, like get to the right diagnosis. Yes, I think that you will, but there's some limited cases with respect to maybe a physical therapy based, you know, what would be appropriate to actually consult you to the emergency room, and also has to relate to exercise. Because again, if we open this up to like motor vehicle accidents or like equestrian injury or something, like I could find some weird stuff. And in fact, I do have a weird case at the end that I want to tell you about, but yeah, I've talked long enough. Let's get into this. It's a 29-year-old man with no past medical history. He presents to the emergency room with severe pain in both legs. That's gone on for about an hour. The patient says that 1 hour ago, he was competing in a national-level powerlifting meet, and while attempting to squat 620 pounds or 280 kilograms, he felt severe pain in both legs during the descent, and he fell to the floor. He reports pain now in the front of both thighs that are about the same, and he is unable to walk without assistance. He has severe pain when attempting to even bear weight. He denies pain in his hips, groin, ankles, or feet. He denies loss of consciousness, any recent illnesses, or previous episodes like this. He does report taking anabolic steroids, though he is not sure the names of the agents that he's taken or the doses. So before we go any further and I give you some like physical exam findings or whatever, why don't you tell the listeners your thought process when evaluating a patient like this? And if you're playing along at home, this is the time to pause and you do your own sort of differential diagnosis, what's going on with the patient. And then you can click play and come back and see if you're on the same page.
Well, there was definitely a mechanism of injury. And that tends to be kind of the first thing that really differentiates out of it because, well, one, if you're presenting to an ED with just symptoms and no mechanism, that's probably something falling a little bit more in the chronic category to begin with. But here you had an individual coming out of a squat. So your initial things that would be very high looking towards is some type of tendon tear. In this instance, a quad tendon tear would be very high. Depending on what else happened along the way, you may be suspicious of an ACL tear, MCL tear, or any ligamentous injury out of it. For that, a lot of it's going to be, what does the physical exam look like? Do you see any retractions of muscles? Did they feel a pop? What does the swelling in the knee look like? And that's going to kind of guide where we're going to go out of this. Just from what you have said thus far, though, this individual is very likely going to need imaging to discern what along the way, as much as any orthopedic special test is going to give us information.
Okay, well, let's get into it then. Yeah, it sounds like to me, though, you're saying the mechanism of injury is your primary sort of focus as far as trying to figure out like what went wrong, in addition to the deficits that the person is presenting with, which it makes sense to me. But I think for our listeners at home, you know, if they're trying to do this DIY or what was that show? Was it something medicine, Dr. Quinn, medicine woman kind of thing? If they're trying to figure this out at home, you know, for maybe their own sort of injury or something like that. I guess what I'd want to know is there sort of like an algorithm that you go through like from top to bottom? Like, what does that actually look like?
Well, most of the time, the first question when I get a call from a friend with something like this is, can you walk on it? And if the answer is no, then that is a do not pass, go straight to the ED and get it looked at side of things. But it also does correlate with mechanism of injury because for something like an ACL tear or even any acute ligamentous tear, a lot of times those aren't necessarily emergent things. But in this instance, like I would put it more in that category with it having the possibility of being a tendon rupture. So out of that, if you can walk on it is the biggest thing. How swollen is it and what does your range of motion look like? And then in an instance like this, if it were more of a landing type mechanism or something with like a massive impulse behind it, I might be a little bit more concerned about something fracture related. But considering this was more of a bottom of the squat in a like post adolescent male, then that kind of takes away a lot of like the fracture way of thinking about it, which makes it less emergent. And a lot of after hours ortho clinics or even like next day can still get you in to do an evaluation. And I don't think in instances where there's a lower suspicion of fracture that it needs to be immediately expedited straight to the ED.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well, this guy's already in the emergency room, so let's do an exam on him. He appears to be in pain, but he's otherwise alert, oriented, and coherent. A focused musculoskeletal exam of the lower extremities was performed, and that showed that both limbs are warm and well perfused. His skin is intact with no lacerations or wounds. He does have bilateral swelling, mostly focused in the anterior thigh compartment, so above the patella, and there are palpable gaps between the distal end of his quadriceps muscles bilaterally and the upper aspect, the superior aspect of the patella. He has normal range of motion and strength in both hips and ankles. His passive range of motion in the knees bilaterally are painful, but normal. Knee flexion strength is about 4 out of 5, but painful. And knee extension strength is 1 out of 5 and very, very painful. His distal pulses are normal and intact. In the emergency room, he did have x-rays of both lower extremities that showed no fractures or avulsions to the femur or tendon or anywhere near there. And he's got bilateral lateral patella displacement that was evident on both x-rays. So before we go any further, how does this change your thinking or sort of move you closer to a diagnosis?
Well, out of the gate, just from the mechanism, it if we're talking about pretest probability, the number one thing that's kind of coming into the radar is quad tendon issues. But it's not necessarily just that. So the game is much more quad tendon and possibly something else. With the retraction or the noticeable displacement of the patella and retraction of the quadriceps muscle, you know, at that point, I think your suspicions should be pretty high on that side of the equation. No acute fractures. Once again, I wouldn't have suspected anything like that out of it. The only thing that might have like clued you in a little bit more off the x-ray is sometimes you'll have what's called a Sagoon fracture, which is a fibular fracture that's more indicative of an ACL tear. But that was just, once again, we're likely going to send this individual to the answer donut just to confirm whatever ligamentous stability is also warranted to be addressed.
Yeah. So at this point, unfortunately, this case report was quite limited in the information that it provided before the diagnosis came along. So you'll actually be tasked with coming up with the diagnosis prior to getting an MRI, because this patient actually did not have an MRI before treatment. So final answer, diagnosis. If you're playing it along at home, press pause, come up with your final diagnosis, and then you can press play. What's your final diagnosis though?
Bilateral quad tendon tears.
Yay. There you go.
Yeah.
That's the patient was diagnosed with the complete bilateral quadriceps tendon rupture. So both sides, which was confirmed intraoperatively and subsequently repaired. Both legs were immobilized in a fixed extension brace for 6 weeks post-op. And then when he returned to the clinic 5 months later, he actually had an MRI at that point, which showed a right ACL injury. Although the MRI was performed because he was reporting instability in that right knee at follow-up, and I guess he had a grade 2 Lachman test. What is a Lachman test, and like what does that grade mean? So for the listeners at home.
So a Lachman is the orthopedic test where we check for an ACL rupture. You put the athlete in a little bit of knee flexion and you basically anterior tibially translate or pull forward on their tibia in the motion that the ACL would restrain against. And what you're looking for is a firm infeel out of it. So if someone has an ACL, you kind of feel a dead stop on it. Whereas if they don't, you just kind of feel their tibia keep going. And in the word that you'll sometimes hear is like, it's an empty infeel. It just keeps going. But for any individual, if you're pulling a Lachman on it, you should feel like a thud at the end of the test every time. So, mm-hmm.
So, and the grading, is it opposite where a higher number is better or worse, or a lower number is better or worse?
I'll be honest. The grading tends to be more positive, negative, and anything in between. If we did, I would be fascinated to see a validity study of grading versus MRI comparison. It tends to be yes, no more than anything that I would personally grade out.
Yeah. That's kind of the same thing with like a strength test, right? So there's like the, you know, 0 out of 5, 1 out of 5, 2 out of 5, 3 all the way to 5 out of 5. And then especially neurologists and PM&R specialists will use like plus minus at various numbers. And so, you know, I remember reading in a few patients' charts, oh, this patient had 4 minus out of 5 strength in this particular area. And I was like, yeah, I don't know exactly how that's been. I mean, obviously, it's the clinician's judgment at that point, but it would be interesting to compare that to 100 other clinicians' judgments of like force production at a particular position and joint and everything else.
Well, and manual muscle testing was originally created for spinal cord injury people. So in that instance, like if you're grading against, is it there? How much is it there? Is it functional? Then I could see parsing it out. But I'm sure at this point post-injury, this individual, which I actually pretty sure I know the case you've given me, it would rank as a 4 out of 5. But if we're talking about from the force that this individual is probably able to produce 6 hours prior, I'm willing to bet you're talking about a 50% drop off in ability to produce force from symptoms and other issues at bay. But if you have someone squatting 660 and even I'm pushing down on their hip into abduction as hard as I can, that individual is probably going to be able to resist me even with a significant deficit in strength for what is normal for them.
Yeah, I think with the knee extension on this particular patient, it's like, well, there's the tendon's not really attached, and so they're contracting, and you see some movement, but not of the joint, because you're like, well, dang, it's not really connected anymore. So
yeah, it's you see movement, but it's not where you would expect or hope for the movement to be.
Right, you're like, oh, that looks strange. Yeah. So anyway, so who's diagnosed post-op with an ACL tear, and at this point, the quadriceps tendon was deemed healed. And he was started in an ACL rehabilitation program rather than going back to surgery. At 8 months of follow-up, the patient had returned to normal activity. He had no symptoms of right knee instability at this time. So he kind of made a full recovery, which is what we're going to talk about for the rest of the podcast. Both, one, what are some risk factors for tendon ruptures? In this case, I wanted to focus on anabolic androgenic steroids, so AAS. And then I also wanted to talk about ACLs. So let's start off with these AAS or anabolic androgenic steroids and their risk for tendon rupture. Before I get in, I know I'm familiar with quite a bit of the literature on this, but just point blank, if I ask you, are PEDs, particularly anabolic steroids, a risk factor for tendon rupture? What's your just, you know, off the cuff answer on that?
My off the cuff is it's not as strong as if you would have asked me this 5 years ago. It really looks like the evidence. It used to be something that we're like, oh, are you on PEDs, and immediately consumed that there were, or assumed that there was an increased risk. But my understanding of the evolution of the literature, especially over the fast or the past 5 years, is that isn't the case as much. And I think it's probably a little bit, were we getting artifact of individuals who were just admitting PED use back in the day, and now it's a more open discussion. So we're starting to see a more of a baseline adjustment from athletes that we know that are using gear in not having problems. And it just turns out that odds are, if you are on anabolic steroids, there's also a decent chance that you have your training dialed to 11, which that in and of itself also increases the risk of this injury as much as anything else.
Yeah, I think we share that sort of view on the evolution of the data. But if you just go look at the data, and in particular, if you're unfamiliar with maybe the gym scene. So I can imagine a clinician, you know, a sports med person who's maybe they're an endurance athlete or that's their focus, for example. And then, you know, they're not too much into resistance training and they just look at the evidence. Yeah, they would probably come down to the conclusion that it looks like there's some risk here. So for example, there are a number of case reports suggesting that anabolic steroids may be a potential risk factor for tendon rupture. For example, one case report, all four individuals who had ruptured their triceps brachii muscle and the subsequent tendon had previously taken oral anabolic steroids prior to their injury. Same thing for a pec tendon avulsion during bench press. There were a number of patients, 48 patients who had this injury, and 96% of them had admitted to using anabolic steroids. Perhaps one of the most interesting studies I found, this is brand new. This looked at people who had just been prescribed testosterone, right? And they followed them for a year. So they had 150,000 patients who got a testosterone prescription, men and women, interestingly, but that's for another podcast discussion. 150,000 men patients, mostly men, but some women, who had filled a testosterone prescription, and they were compared to age and sex matched controls and followed for a year. Over that year, there were 97 quadriceps tendon injuries in the prescription group and only 18 in the controls. And so that's like a, you know, pretty significant risk apparently in this particular group. So again, if you just looked at the existing evidence, you'd say, you know, damn it, it seems like there's some sort of risk here from anabolics.
But I would probably push back and ask to see their training history and what they were doing during that time, because my knee-jerk reaction from having worked with plenty of athletes that are on anabolics is it tends to be the, I would say, the misconception that you can just push intensity really high out of it. And if I didn't see what their programming was and what they were trying to do, to me, like, but you know, there obviously is a risk there, but it's almost as much of a psychological programming conversation around how much should we be sending maximum intensity, even though we're an enhanced athlete at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. Which so again, if you keep looking at the literature, there's two major mechanisms that are suggested. But I think both of these are completely off the reservation and have no bearing on this. But I will tell for the audience at home and for us to discuss, the first mechanism, which is very commonly promoted, is this is probably what's going on, is that there's little to no deleterious effect on the tendons themselves. Yeah, from anabolic steroid use, but there's like this disproportionate hypertrophy and strength response of the muscles compared to subsequent tendon adaptation. So, you know, in short, the muscle becomes too strong for the tendon, and subsequently you get a tendon failure at, in this case, the worst possible time. So that's probably the most common mechanism that's suggested in the literature, but that'd be really difficult to test in some sort of way without like, okay, we've tested your muscle strength. We have some value. And then we test the resiliency of your tendon without causing it to fail in a live patient. It's going to be hard to test. The second most common mechanism that you see in the literature, this is mostly from animal studies that show some sort of collagen dysplasia in response to being administered anabolic steroids. So they cause the tendons to become stiffer and less flexible, which subsequently could lead to a greater risk of failure. Although this hasn't been shown in humans. Again, it is harder to study because you can't usually sacrifice the human to study their tendons after you've dosed them with a bunch of anabolic steroids. So I think you and I are both in agreement that that's it seems unlikely, but rather this third factor or risk, you know, mechanism is rarely discussed. But I feel like this is the most likely thing. It's a training related thing, right? So load mismanagement, as you were pointing out, like pushing it too quickly, perhaps a greater exposure. If you are an individual who is either hypogonadal before and now are on TRT, or you're a person using these recreationally for performance enhancing purposes, it is probable, if not definitively true, that you are exercising more than people who did not seek out a testosterone prescription or are not using anabolics for recreational purposes, which means that not only are you exposed more to a potential, you know, mechanism of injury here, but you're also likely training harder than you otherwise would. Now, again, to your point, is it a psychological thing, right? Is there something going on there where you're like, man, I feel like I'm just getting stronger all the time. I got to up the weight because it's got to be hard enough to drive these adaptations. And if that's true, then how do you regulate that, right? So if you were my coach, for example, right, and I was emailing you and saying, look, man, I'm just so strong. I don't know what to tell you. Like every time I go to hit my target work sets each week, it's just light, you know? And if you were of the opinion like, well, this – look, man, natural guy. He's just getting stronger. My program's working. Hey, man, just keep adding weight. That may not – yeah, it's hard to judge. Like how do you make sure that you're keeping pace with your, quote, tendon adaptations in this particular case? That's a challenge.
Well, and I don't think there's a good answer to it. And some of it, as a coaching side of it, it comes down to having the conversation with the patient of, or the athlete of like, how much risk are we willing to incur out of here? Like if you tell me you're trying to train for Worlds in your meet 6 months from now, like, hey, let's keep the hammer down. If you're doing it because you want to be the heaviest squatter in Boise, Idaho at a local gym meet, then like, maybe we should dial it back a little bit and allow a little bit more adaptation to come out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I do wonder, I mean, I've certainly my personal experience in untested meets versus tested meets, there do seem to be more musculoskeletal injuries that occur at untested meets compared to tested meets, and not just, you know, tendon ruptures, but just any sort of musculoskeletal injury, whether or not that's due to the, you know, direct effects of anabolic steroids themselves, the training practices, you know, of people using that, or just like the environment, the competitive environment. I can't say, but I do think there's some maybe anabolic steroid related factor likely having to do with training and subsequent preparation for the test, in this case, a powerlifting meet, that may be a risk factor.
Well, and I would be interested to hear your thoughts on this because I'm going to shoot from the hip a little bit. But I also think the kind of accepted side of it is if an athlete goes on gear, they're going to be able to tolerate more volume. And almost always from a coaching perspective, the first thing that starts changing is that overall bolus of volume goes up, and at a certain point you can't adapt beyond that, because I'm sure if I gave you some programs and that are perfectly fine for geared athletes to run, and you looked at how it was structured, you would be like, this is for a geared athlete.
Mm. Yeah, it'd be hard to parse out on paper. And I think it's just the way I think about this personally, right? It's like the main function of PEDs, in this case, anabolic steroids, is to increase your adaptation rate. So not only how much faster you're getting stronger, gaining muscle mass, gaining cardiorespiratory fitness, if it's like an EPO, you know, something like that. So not anabolic steroids in that case. So not only that, but also the size of the adaptations. So yet you're getting stronger and bigger faster, but also the amount of improvement is larger than it otherwise would be without sort of enhancement. But that just means you're getting more out of doing the same, right? That doesn't necessarily mean that you should do more to get even more than that, if that makes sense. So I do work with both enhanced and natural athletes, and the programs look pretty similar, obviously with individual adjustments based on that person. But I do think, to your point, it is very common that people start using and there's some psychological like motivation, like, okay, I'm doing this, I'm locked in, I'm gonna adjust my diet, my sleep, I'm focused, I gotta, you know, whatever. And they jack their training up to 11, when previously maybe it was at a 7 or an 8. And to me, I'm here for the motivation. I'm here for the excitement. I'm here for the dedication. I'm not here for this sort of let's dump the, jack the training load way, way up because we can. You've said it a bunch of times, like just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And I think that would be maybe an interesting study design if you looked at people who started using and kept their same program versus people who started using and switched to a different program with a higher training load. Like, is that the signal that we're really picking up here? To me, that seems more likely, but it'd be admittedly a little bit hard to study.
It would also be almost impossible to get the athletes to be completely honest about what's going on as well. And that's not a knock against them, but if there's one thing that comes up time and again, if you're using trained athletes in a study, one, putting them in a control group and letting them know it's a control group is almost always a good way to not have good results. And everyone wants to do the thing that they think is going to work the most. So,
yeah, there's some interesting ways that they've tried to ascertain whether or not people are telling the truth when it comes to being asked about their substance use. And so they'll ask them questions that are like unrelated. And they're kind of like true false, and they have to answer true false. And it's like, if they give you the correct answer, then the next question's answer is more likely to be true. it's something to that effect. So it's kind of an interesting way to do it. But yeah, I don't know. I share your opinion though. I don't know that just the use of anabolic steroids at any particular dose generates a unique risk factor for tendon rupture or even musculoskeletal injuries in isolation. I think rather it has to be paired with some sort of training load mismatch, some sort of what we would consider maybe irresponsible load selection or whatever, which is likely related to anabolic steroid use, but not directly causal. Does that make sense to you, or do you think I'm just making an argument?
No, I'm in very much agreement with all of this.
All right. Well, there you go. I remain open to changing my opinion if new data emerges. But yeah, that TRT study was super interesting to me. That just popped up on my radar maybe a month ago, and I was like, wait, one, why are women being – it was like 20,000 women in this cohort of 150,000 people. Why are they being prescribed testosterone? It's not unheard of, to be clear. Like, this is not unheard of, but 20,000 to me felt like a big number. And I'm like – are just people on TRT, they're seeing more, tendon injuries. Interesting. It's interesting. I don't know that absolves my mechanism, my proposed mechanism, but it was interesting.
I also think there's a little bit of a conversation about just development in sport, because if it would be in the differential for a muscle injury and this individual was an adolescent, you would still get an X-ray because you would be concerned about an avulsion fracture. And then for the recreational, more like running related injuries or something quick, like a lot of times we think of that more being in the muscle belly itself. And if you look at the imaging studies, that has a strong correlation. But it seems with more the resistance training side of things, where it is, even though you are trying to accelerate the weight as fast as you can, it's still going slow, where that failure point tends to be most of the time, even in non-enhanced individuals, is that tendon side of it. And if you look at it, you know, if I hate to use this example because I don't want to open this can of worms, but the whole like mixed grip deadlift side of it, that's always a bicep tendon coming off, not the belly itself. And that's not even for individuals running anabolics. And I think at a certain point, if you are at like maximum force production for whatever that muscle can produce, like, well, you're taxing the tendon to its maximal load as well. Just instead of it being in the belly itself, you're going to get the tendon side of it. And that's with or without any subsequent steroid use.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, let's put a bow on this and maybe we'll just open ourselves up to criticism. If we had to figure out a strategy to maybe minimize any sort of indirect increase in tendon injury risk from anabolic use, from a coaching standpoint, you know, my first thought would be, and something I've used quite a bit, is that I cap the progression rate that somebody can use, meaning that we almost turn it into like a linear progression with respect to loading. Like you can only go up 5 kilos, for example. That's the maximum I'm going to let you go up. You can obviously go lower if you happen to not be feeling awesome that day, or repeat the weight. Again, if you feel like your performance is static from week over week. But if you're feeling awesome, be careful. You know, let's exercise some caution here, and you can only go up by a little bit. Again, that's made up. I don't know that actually like reduces the risk, right? Like, but I do feel better about that sort of like I'm putting constraints on how quickly they can add training load.
Well, we use that all the time in the rehab side of things, especially for individuals that where you have to be a little bit more concerned about physiological adaptation, like the ACL example there, to where the athlete might be able to use much more weight, but our rate limiting step is we need to be concerned with that ACL healing. So I don't want to expose it to maximum load, even if that athlete could use much more load than what they're currently have on their back or whatever exercise we're using at the time. So quite often it'll be, you know, work up to 160 kilo or RPE 7, but the hard cap is the 160 kilo or wherever it happens to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty confident that any sort of, particularly for strength, that anything over about 70%, give or take, is probably will work to make people stronger. And I don't know that like 80% is better than 70% for strength gain for multi-rep sets, for example. So I am good with exercising some caution. I'm like, look, if we add a few kilos week over week or every 2 weeks, that's fine. We don't need to go way heavier in order to get a bigger sort of adaptation. In fact, I think not only the training stimulus to fatigue ratio gets a little disproportionate, but also I think the risk of injury likely goes up in this particular setting due to the lack of like preparation. The problem is, as you know, you've experienced from people you've worked with, it's addicting. If you're getting so much stronger week over week, like how could you could tell somebody, look, hey man, only add 5 kilos, but they're like, sir, I'm so much stronger and this is so much fun. Let me do it, dad. And you're like, well,
I'll show my hand to the listeners a little bit. If anyone ever works with me in the future, wants to call me out on it. Quite often, if I have an athlete like that, the supplemental work on the back end will be so gnarly that I'm trying to disincentivize them sending it. I'm like, well, just because we can't get it on a squat or a deadlift doesn't mean we still can't chase a pump somewhere else. But I want to do it in something that's more constrained to where my concern is going to be lower about you sending it past where it needs to be.
Yeah. Yeah. some practical strategies may be like, instead of taking a top multi-rep set to RP 8 or 9, maybe it's 6 or 7. Instead of doing the single, if you're someone's doing single rep efforts for like powerlifting purposes or one rep max training purposes, instead of doing that first and fresh, I might do it after all the multi-rep sets. So somebody does like 5 sets of 5 at 70% and then does a single afterwards. The idea is there's some fatigue ready that already that's like limiting their ability to send it. And yeah, as you mentioned, some of the accessory work, if somebody does want to go a little bit harder on that, well, we do it in a way that's maybe a little bit more controlled, less, you know, not as high velocity, for example, and have put some bumpers up like we're bowling, you know, kind of keep them, save them from themselves. Those would be some ideas about how maybe an enhanced athlete's program would be different than a natural athlete's program. Although again, I know personally of instances where the programs look almost the exact same because the athletes were at very similar spots in their training career. And so it'd be hard just to recognize, oh, this is for sure a person that's using versus a person that's not based on their programming.
Well, I mean, I think if it was like a top single at 8 and 8 back off sets at a 15% drop, you would be like, well, I hope you're supplementing somewhere. So either that, or I'm really concerned about where that single at 8 is. So
totally. Yeah. I think one, I'm trying to think of the most back off sets I've ever done. I think to share her program for me, it was like 7 triples, like as a back off. And I remember I sent him a message. I go, dude, this is too many sets. Like not that I can't handle volume, like I can, but I'm just like, I think I'm going to be, you know, pretty sore. And this is more sets than I've ever done. Are you sure? He's like, well, let's just try it. It was 1 week. And I go, nah, man. No, I'm out. Cut the volume down. I need. He's a good coach. And instead of saying, hey, have you thought about taking anabolics? He was like, oh, I'll just cut the volume down. So, hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine. And over the last 10 plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 annual data breach report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the US in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. 2025 is here, which probably means you're reflecting on what you hope to achieve and perhaps even considering some New Year's resolutions. Learning a new language in 2025 with Rosetta Stone is a great goal, which comes with the added benefits of exploring new cultures, connecting more deeply with others, and oh, by the way, it's 50% off for life. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for the last 30 years, with millions of users in 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app so you can learn anytime, anywhere, and it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice quickly, along with the correct accent using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. And did I mention it's 50% off for life? Start the new year off with a resolution you can reach. There's no better time than right now to get started, and Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Head over to rosettastone.com/today and get 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Again, it's 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, well, let's move on to some ACL stuff. It is strange you brought this up. We don't actually have a lot of information on ACL ruptures, return to play, anything like that. So this is some motivation to do that.
Yeah. We can start wherever you would like out of it, because this is an instance where I would say in the scientific literature, we have a lot of information that says that we are not doing a great job of hitting the metrics we should be hitting out of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's start off with a little anatomy here then, and then we'll get into ask you some questions about, mechanisms of injury, rehab stuff, return to sport, and so on. So the anterior cruciate ligament, it's the ACL, is a band of connective tissue. It's mostly type 1 collagen, and it runs from the femur to the tibia, and its main job is to resist the tibia, that's your lower leg bone, from moving forward relative to the femur. Also, there's some tibial anti-rotation sort of function there. It forms an X with the posterior cruciate ligament, the PCL, which is where it gets its name from, as cruciate is a derivative of the Latin word cruciatus, which means crossed or overlapping. So the crural or cruce ligaments of the knee, they just looks like an X. And I can confirm, after taking apart close to 400 knees in the anatomy lab, yep, it does look like an X, although you have to flex the knee in order to see said X. But it's there, plain as day. The ACL is the most injured knee ligament, and with a yearly incidence of about 100 to 200,000 ruptures per year in the United States, though the incidence is likely higher than that because there's no real surveillance system for the general public. We have some surveillance systems in high school sports and college sports and some professional sports, but outside of that, there's no like national ACL injury, registry for all comers. And some people have likely injured their ACL, but otherwise not seen a doctor about it or had it repaired. The NCAA, for example, has this surveillance system that's been in place since 1988. But, other than that, there's not this national registry for non-athletes. In your estimation, Dr. Miles, what is the major mechanism of injury for the ACL?
It tends to be a really quick valgus and anterior tibial translation moment. So in common parlance, it's a big breaking moment. So it's often when an athlete is running full speed and comes to a quick stop or lands. And there tends to be a little bit of a combination of some of that anterior translation and valgus out of it. It's one of those things when you see it happen on the field, a lot of times you could probably skip the Lockman step out of it because the mechanism is so distinct when it is there. But it is... people don't tear their ACLs jumping, they tear their ACLs landing. And it is that distinction between the two, because that really factors in a lot in the conversation and even how we rehab and do programming, because it's one thing to have both feet leave the ground, but how are we addressing the landing and the bigger impulse and force on striking the ground and getting some exposures there?
Yeah. Most of the time in the literature, they talk about like a high energy or low energy sort of, mechanism of injury. So like a high energy one would be like a motor vehicle accident, car crash, skiing at high rate of speed and clipping something or whatever. But the more common mechanism, as you mentioned, is this what's called actually a low energy sort of mechanism of injury. So either contact to the lateral knee while the leg is planted, like in American football, or other, landing and having that sort of valgus moment where the knee caves in. That seems to be pretty common. The thing about the valgus thing, and I want to get your take on this. People will read that or learn that, particularly like physical therapy school, athletic training school, some personal training certifications, and then take from that, well, valgus is bad. Just knee valgus is bad because if you land, with a high amount of force and your knee, you have some valgus knee where it caves in, that's a risk for ACL tear and injury. does that mean that all valgus knee is bad? Like, I feel like that's a leap that people are just taking. Is that taught? Is it like, what, where am I getting this from?
It's definitely still taught. It's still relatively dogmatic. I would fall more into the camp of, if we're going to need those positions in sport, we should get some exposures in training. And just like with everything else, there's always going to be like a novelty factor to it, to where if you have spent your entire life training this perfect jump mechanism, whatever we call that to be, and then your setter pushes you outside and you have to go for the ball as an outside hitter, well, you're going to have to adjust to that. So at some point, like, sports and training is inherently dirty in that you have to react to everything going on in the environment. But when we talk about valgus and how it's quote unquote trained, a lot of times it's always in a very sterile environment. I'm going to teach you the perfect 45 degree cut or how to decelerate. And that's great. But, you know, the way I explain it to athletes all the time, if you're a wide receiver and you have a perfect 45 degree cut and I'm playing corner against you, the first thing I'm going to take away from you is that cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. How much of this, like, okay, so like in baseball, there's a pitch count, right? For a lot of pitchers, they say, oh, you're 80 pitch, you're out. You know, or we're only going to let you, especially if they're coming back from like an injury or overuse, you know, type thing. You can pitch, you know, 60 pitches and then we're pulling you. That's just, we're trying to make sure that the exposure doesn't outstrip your sort of capacity right now. Or even in golf, okay, you can hit this many balls or whatever, you know, or we're going to cap you. That doesn't really happen in most sports that involve like jumping, cutting, pivot, whatever. And so you could say, like, why is there no like jump count in, you know, a basketball for somebody coming back from an ACL injury? It's mostly time, right? They have like, oh, you can play this many minutes, and they're assuming, oh, there's X amount of plays per minute, and so we're trying to control the dose that way. But does that, do you think that there's some sort of, whether it's a re-injury risk or whether it's an injury risk before somebody's had an issue, do you think there's any element of like, look, this person had a heavy practice week, and now during the match, the game, the competition, they've sort of outkicked their coverage, and so that they're like fatigue is like a plays a role here?
Well, they're starting to monitor that a lot more in especially professional level sports. And it'll be interesting to see how the data evolves over the next 5-10 years. But I do think I would slant that there is a fatigue role in it, but I would probably step back and say it's more when we start having inflections in training and competition exposure. So if you look, the NFL is where most of the data conversations always come from. And there does tend to be that uptick at the preseason side of it. And no matter how much you're training in the off season, if you go to 10 hours a day of practice, your odds are you're going to have an inflection point there. And so it's not even, once again, that like valgus is bad or jumping or landing is bad. It's much more like how much and how hard. But the issue is, the second we start putting these hard caps on things, there's two issues. One, not every athlete needs the same hard cap. And two, like, how do we count a jump as a jump? Because to your comparison there with a pitch count, there was a study that came out probably 6 or 7 years ago now that looked at the Little League pitch count. And what they found was, that's great that we have this pitch count, but some of these kids were throwing 40 hard pitches in bullpen before they ever stepped on the mound. So do those count as well? And if not, then now that pitch count needs to be much lower, or how do we titrate accordingly? And I don't think there's ever going to be a definitive yes, no, because it's always risk. But that's where it becomes really incumbent on the coach to scale said risk. And, you know, you and I have already discussed ways and strategies of like titrating an athlete back who might be gaining a little bit too much too soon. And in the rehab setting, the framework that has been kind of popularized and I like is the like participation, practice, play. So as we start hitting our metrics, like ACL being the example of a certain strength, limb symmetry index, certain normative values and time, we start increasing the exposures in participation, where the athlete can really self-regulate how hard they're going and the coach's eye is going to be on it, and then start giving them more exposures into the practice setting. And once we've gotten back in shape and checked those boxes, going back to competition. The bigger issue being, in one, ACL return to sport testing, even though the literature, if you look at how often it's done to the standard that the literature says we should do it, it's not often at all. And once an athlete's cleared, most of the time it's not, let's scale up to it. It's, hey, go with God. Good luck. We're back to full competition.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think conceptually it makes sense, and we you know, most people would likely agree that you want to make sure that a person's preparation is proportional to what's being asked of them. They're adequately prepared for the tasks of not only practice and play, but also you know, the ability to basically be unrestricted when it comes to competition. The problem is putting specific numbers on this, right? So you got to like calculate a particular, you know, acute to chronic work ratio, or, you know, throws or jumps or whatever. It's hard to not only assess those things, but even if you can assess them, coming up with a number or a range of numbers that suits everybody. And it's like, conceptually, again, the concept is good, but the implementation of that with like rigid barriers, that's pretty sticky. And I think, you know, aspirational goals, maybe, like, look, if we can do a blood test where it's like, oh, the hydroxyproline content in your, you know, blood is, you know, directly proportional to tendon stress, whatever that means. I'm just making up neologisms at this particular point. But if we could use that and come up with a range, like you're in the safe window or you're in the risky window or what, I suspect, again, inter-individual variation is going to make that not work. But it would be cool if we had something like that.
Well, and to even pull it back to this specific case, if you look at the literature, one of the big things that's really come out over the last decade is time being an important factor. And really that 9 months is really where the ACL is quote unquote healed by literature standards. And I will fully concede there's a lot of gray area to that. But that when we talk return to sport, most of the time in ACLs, we're talking about cutting sports. In fact, the main reason that we do ACL reconstructions is to increase the likelihood of returning to what's called level one sports, which are cutting, jumping for all intents and purposes. And this individual returned in 8 months, and I would love to go back and look at the numbers on what percentage was considered return to prior level at that point, because I have a feeling there's But you also look at it in the instance of this case in particular. Odds are that ACL tear was a secondary mechanism to his quad tear. And on top of it, you're not having those landing, cutting, running type forces or impulses coming through in powerlifting. So in like, even though by the letter of the literature, this individual didn't have an ACL reconstruction, but like for an ACL reconstruction, 9 months is kind of our benchmark. That doesn't mean that this individual couldn't be training in SBD fashion much prior to this.
Yeah, far sooner. Yeah, I remember I was in a meet in New York in 2015, and I know this man personally, but he's going to remain anonymous. He walks out his squat. I had my back to him. I was like, oh, this is opening attempt. He's going to get this. I don't need to watch. But, you know, I just wait for the applause. That's how you know in powerlifting. It's like you hear up, 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 aw. And you know the lift didn't go. And if you hear applause, you're like, oh, you got it. Perfect. Anyway, I don't hear either of those things. I hear a thud, a massive thud, a groan from a grown man. And then I hear, ooh, this guy, apparently he was known to be a very rapidly descending individual with his squat. And I guess as he went down, he kept going down. Ruptured both quadriceps tendons, bar hits the floor, tore the ACL on one side, fractured one of his femurs and one of his tibias, ultimately went, you know, to the emergency room and spent a couple of days in the hospital getting repaired. But yeah, he was back squatting in, I guess, like 3 months or something like that, which was, I thought, pretty great. I was like, interesting, you know, like, because yeah, the 9 months or whatever, you know, return to sport, you think about, okay, well, a powerlifter doesn't really need to run to squat. They don't need to cut to squat. They kind of just need to be able to walk the weight out with some sort of dynamic control and then go up and down, which is a pretty sterile environment, all things considered.
Yeah. Well, and even out of that, one of the bigger predictors, I mean, for ACL in general, quad strength is the number one thing we look at outside of time. And odds are if you are in your division at a powerlifting meet, this dude's quads were pretty strong to begin with. So you're not digging out of as big of a hole to get back to, I'll say prior numbers, but training is probably a better way of saying it. Because, you know, I had an individual who had an adductor repair 6 or 7 years ago. He tore it pulling 760 and underwent the repair. And in my mind, I was like, well, he's a heavyweight. That's a big tendon to suture back down. Odds are we can start going a little bit more. And him pulling 315, and I would have to go back and look, but I would want to say like 7 weeks is a lot of weight to the average individual. It's 42% of his 1RM.
Yeah.
So it was just like grading back into it according to tolerance. Now, that's not to say that, like, back to our initial conversation, I wasn't a little bit nervous starting this out, but it was like a RPE 4 for the set. And we're still at least like getting the exposures out of it to where he's getting the touches. And once again, we're not going to have this like red light, green light of like, we can't pull. Go find RPE 7 on day one.
Totally.
So
yeah, you got to constrain them. So when people have the ACL tear, usually there's a pop with the feeling of instability / the knee giving out plus swelling. In fact, there's some bleeding into the joint. They call it hemarthrosis. And 3/4 of patients with bleeding into the knee joint actually have an ACL tear. So pretty common there. It can also be associated with a number of other injuries to the meniscus, to the joint capsule, cartilage, other ligaments, or bone injuries, particularly in younger and or older individuals. We've already discussed some of the assessments, so the Lachman test, anterior drawer, there's a pivot test, there's all sorts of instrumentation that's available. As you mentioned, a lot of this is image related sort of diagnosis to confirm, or in some cases intraoperatively, if there are other injuries that require surgical management. In the US, we use MRI pretty much for everything. You're like, you got a musculoskeletal injury. We're going to put you in the diagnosis donut. But ultrasound's actually been making a pretty big push towards being one of the modes that people can use, that clinicians can use to diagnose this sort of stuff. It's more common in Europe, but during med school, we were like part of this pilot program to learn ultrasound really well. And so I got, I would say, reasonably good with an ultrasound. I find that it could be very useful in a clinic if you don't have access to an MRI. If someone was good with an ultrasound, maybe that would be useful if you were undetermined whether or not somebody had a tear. Although I do wonder, if you diagnose somebody in like a primary care sports medicine clinic with an ACL tear via ultrasound, what are the odds that patient goes to the OR with no MRI in the United States?
0%.
That's what I'm saying, right? Like, it's, yeah, highly unlikely at this point, but maybe that changes. The thing with the ultrasound is relatively quick. And if somebody knows what they're doing, like, you could do it on the spot. You don't have to like schedule an appointment. You could just do it in the office, for example, but yeah, we'll see how that changes. Now, a more interesting and more probably germane discussion for people listening to this podcast is going to be the management of an ACL tear. Some people, especially if they're unfamiliar with barbell medicine and kind of what we talked about with respect to other injuries, they're thinking, look, you tear the ACL, you need surgery. I mean, look, tear ligament, repair ligament, return to sport. That's not always the case, though. So when you start thinking about operative management versus conservative management, which would include a skilled physical therapist and team of professionals, where does that – what's that calculus like? How do you end up making that decision?
Well, it's ultimately up to an informed decision by the patient. But once again, the main reason that an individual would undergo ACL reconstruction is to increase the likelihood of returning to level one sports. So cutting, jumping, sports. If you tear your ACL doing jumping jacks and your exercise for the week is going to the grocery store, odds are that doesn't need reconstructed. And there's increasing evidence in the literature, and it'll be interesting to see how this evolves in the future, that the ACL can heal on its own as well. And there have been a few studies over the last 5 years that have looked at this a little bit more. But it used to be that the thought process was you have to reconstruct the ACL because it would reestablish joint kinematics. That's basically been debunked to no end. And it is establishing the new normal. There's some great studies out of the University of Vermont that looked at this. And then the next kind of phase out of it was, well, we're doing it because it will decrease the likelihood of knee OA down the road. That's been pretty much debunked in the literature as well. So once you've had an ACL tear, you are at an increased risk of knee OA. Now, that's a whole different can of worms that there are already barbell mess and podcasts addressing that. But if you participate in a sport that has a high degree of cutting, jumping, change of direction, then in those instances, you can make a case that ACL reconstruction is your best course of action. But what gets failed to really come into discussion a lot of times is all the reconstruction does is give you a new ACL. The entire preparatory work for return to sport is on the rehab side, on the back end. And if you spend the next 9 months, if we use time as our litmus, just picking up light weights and not ever breaking a sweat, and then we try and return to sport, well, you may now have an ACL, but odds are you're not nearly in the shape that you were beforehand.
You're detrained, deconditioned, ultimately less prepared than you were going in to this particular. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's been the classical thing. Like if somebody's in a high demand sport, they got a lot of cutting, as you say, grade one sports, and or if they have significant instability despite some sort of conservative management period, right? Or if there's multiple other associated injuries that already require surgery, so they're like already in there, those have been like, that's, yeah, somebody's kind of queued up for an ACL repair surgically. I think, you know, yes, that shared decision making needs to happen between the patient and the provider, weighing the risks and benefits and such. But one interesting finding that is repeated in the literature is that people, by and large, don't do awesome when after repair. Because what you would assume, if this was just like ligament injured, repair ligament, and then, you know, you return to sport, that they should return to their previous level of play. But that is not always the case. And you think this is mostly a function of their like rehab program or something?
I 100%
think, yourself. Think, oh, you think it's mostly?
No, I would slant it. I won't say 100%, 80-20 rehab program. And if you look at how most programs are structured, they are way too conservative. And there was a paper. So what tends to be, and this has changed over the years, but recently it is that 9 month window hitting a 90% limb symmetry index. So testing your quadriceps side to side with some type of dynamometer, not the handheld stuff we were talking about earlier. And then some places will use things like hop tests or the Y balance. Those have kind of went out of fashion, and I would agree with that. But for that criteria, in a pretty big study that gets cited a lot, only 18% of individuals met it. So if our number is that low, then odds are a lot of that is an artifact of how we are approaching rehab.
Hmm. Yeah. There's probably more. Would you agree that you think there's more to it than just like the sort of functional outcomes? So like in this case, you're referring to strength. You know, you could also assess range of motion. There's a number of like these sort of objective criteria you could assess. You think there's anything to like fear of re-injury and how that affects people's like training? You know, like if they're afraid, oh, I'm going to re-tear this thing. And then you say, look, we're going to do some lateral bounding, get you ready for that. We're going to do some single leg hops, get you ready for return to play. We're going to do some, you know, moderate intensity sort of sprint work, so to speak, to like for mechanics, skill work. But they're afraid they're going to re-tear their recently repaired ACL. Do you think that further compromises the efficacy of their rehab program?
Absolutely. But I would still take that as a component of their rehab program, because then it becomes much more a conversation about graded exposure and how do we scale the exercise accordingly. Fear avoidance beliefs for the past 15 years they've been studied and correlated with return to sport outcomes, because it turns out if you're scared of re-injury, odds are you're probably not going to go back to doing the thing that you were doing. But not only that, if you have been told that if you only do things a certain way and it needs to be this perfect whatever, odds are you're not going to push as hard for what we're doing anyway. And there's even another layer that I would go back into that I think if you talk to a lot of individuals who I personally would consider do a good job with rehab, they would tell you that trained individuals are much easier to rehab because there already is an understanding of training. There's a baseline of strength there. And it's one thing to have to get your quad stronger. It's an entire other component to have to teach you how to train your quad and get it stronger. So if you look at some individuals that may not even be meeting physical activity guidelines, but participating in organized sport and they tear, well, part of it is just getting you in some semblance of shape and teaching you how to train. But that really comes down to the athlete themselves and what their goals are and what their training history is, because in the beginning, rehab is boring. Like, it's like watching paint dry for the first couple of weeks because you're trying to control for swelling. You need to get your terminal knee extension back. You need to hit flexion at a certain point. But once those metrics are there, then it's much more structuring a program to make sure that we are getting quadricep strength back, but we're also keeping you as in shape as we can. Traditional physical therapy might see you two times a week and give you some body weight things to do outside of it. But if even in that 2 hours you may be in a clinic, you're going back to 10 hours a week of training, we're never going to close that gap. And this is where it's much more incumbent on rehab professionals to be able to write, you know, a 3 to 5 day program to meet them where they're at. The athletes need to be doing things outside of the gym. And to the fear side, it's not only the fear of the athlete, it's the fear of the clinician.
Because
if the clinician is constantly like, well, I don't want to do anything taxing because I don't want to be the one to cause a problem. Well, you know, the whole do no harm, if you're not doing enough for the athlete and they're trying to return to sport, I would argue you're kind of doing harm.
Yeah. Insufficient dosing for sure. My dad's getting his knee replaced next week. Actually this week. Tomorrow. Oh my God. But he saw like he had a pre-op consultation with the physical therapist. Right. And they gave him this program to do. Right. It's like a dozen things, only one of which was like an actual exercise to like potentially improve his, you know, strength, his coordination, whatever. Everything else was foam rolling. And he sent me this program. I go, do the exercise, skip the foam rolling. And you have to do these other exercises to not only improve your fitness, but also start training, right? He hadn't been working out for a little bit. And I was like, well, you can still bench press. You can, you know, do some of the seated stuff. Like even if post-op, you'll be able to do seated upper body related things. And all of this stuff, not only to your point, teaches somebody how to train, like how to produce force, motor coordination, et cetera, what's it supposed to feel like difficulty wise, but also just improves their fitness. And it's like, that was my whole point on our podcast 223. We were talking about strength training promotion in physical therapy, in the physical therapy clinic. It's like, yes, people are there for a reason, right? My knee hurts, I'm post-op, I'm whatever. And you do have to address that. I totally understand that. And the logistics around time and seeing multiple patients at one time. But like, I would prefer if in that setting they were also generally promoting exercise of the rest of the body. You got a bunch of other stuff going on there, you know? So would prefer in this particular case, post ACL repair, they're in the clinic, you're seeing them, you're doing your range of motion stuff, you're doing some strength stuff. Well, what about the upper body? They can do upper body work. They can do, you know, other stuff with the lower extremities that doesn't involve the knee. You can figure out ways to train. That's your whole training, right? That's your job. So I don't know if you agree, or maybe that's just I'm just being overly critical.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. And I think honestly, like having transitioned over to working in the online space with Barbell Medicine has very much had an effect on the way that I think about it, because coming up, I certainly was in the, well, I have you two times a week in clinic. We're going to do it here. Here's some easier things to go do on your own because I'm not there standing watching it. So it made me a little nervous versus moving to the online space. I'm like, well, I'm not going to see you do every rep anyway. So I need to trust that you can do it. However, why in the hell am I only giving you 2 days a week when we have all this other time to do stuff? And not only that, back to kind of some of the barriers to entry. If I need you to do 5 very boring things that, let's face it, I don't want to do, and I know you're bored doing them, at least if I put like 3 or 4 fun upper body things in there, I can get you to the gym, and you're like, okay, I need to go do the boring things so I can go do the fun things. And we're also trying to like chalk up some wins at the time. So if we may not be able to squat or deadlift or pick an exercise, but it's like, well, you know, like last week, this week, this is 10 more pounds on that pull down, or like, you know, no one's ever been, or no one's ever complained about getting a more jacked upper body through the rehab time. And it's like, well, guess what? We can bro out, but it's also having equipment in a clinic to where you can do that. Like, I'm very fortunate where I am now, because at RTS, we have literally every piece of arsenal equipment ever made. And the nice part about having all those machines is like, well, we can just go get on the machines and hang your leg off to the side and chase a pump for a little while.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. There's the systematic effects of exercise should not be overlooked. Right. So every time if you do an upper body exercise, it's going to do something to the rest of your body. Crosstalk between, like, look, if you have one leg that's got an ACL tear and the other leg is relatively normal, single leg work, single leg press, single leg extension, hamstring curl, like whatever. So it's going to talk to the other side a little bit. And so I just feel like there's this opportunity to not only promote exercise, generally speaking, in physical therapy, but also just to improve the fitness of the entire person outside of just focusing on the quote unquote reason why they're there. The chief complaint is like, you're going to see this person, two dozen times before they leave your care. Like, man, we could really do some cool stuff.
Well, and there's always a conversation in ACL rehab that's like, it's the quad till it isn't, which I fully agree with. However, it's the athlete that has a quad. So why are we not structuring things to keep that person as athletic as they can? And there's always ways of working around a problem. And, it, you know, straight leg raises have a place in a program, and I certainly use them early on. But at a certain point, like, there has to be some external load. If, you know, I had an athlete who I saw for the first 8 weeks of their rehab in a clinic. And when I moved on to another assignment, they were using 45 pounds for knee extension. Went on to my other assignment, came back and saw them at 9 months. They were using 45 pounds. Like, so in the last 7 months, we haven't increased the weight here at all on one of the primary drivers that we're going to be testing against. And it wasn't that it was any or the same amount of hard, but you got to be comfortable allowing the athlete to take themselves up. One of my more recent athletes, you know, if we're in clinic doing isometrics, I'm in his ear yelling at him in the most bro way I can say it while he's doing it. And he went to go test. And the second he started testing on the IceKinetic dynamometer, everyone in the clinic, he said, stopped and looked at him because they're just not used to someone like sending it on the machine like that.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if we're calling this a maximum test, then we want to be able to give maximum effort the whole time. So we need to train that athlete in how to give maximum effort, which is also a pretty big demand for most sports.
Yep. Yeah. Some encouragement may be necessary. Well, to wrap this up, so obviously you're, again, head of the Barbell Medicine Pain and Rehab Department. If somebody has a recent either ACL injury or repair, is this something that you guys can handle? Can you do their rehab, or like, do you prefer this is like post-op for a certain time, or what do you guys do?
Absolutely. We've had plenty that have reached out pre-op. We've seen them through that time and then through post-op day one all the way through. I am going to make a little distinction on something you've said a couple of times for the listeners, because I know at least one of my PT friends is going to send me a text about this. We're not repairing, we're reconstructing.
Sure.
So it's an ACL reconstruction outside of the bear procedure, which is a repair. But for our typical grafts that we use, it's always a reconstruction. But that being said, that way all of you cannot text me who are listening to this that want to blow me up over not fixing that. We're happy to do it all. And on top of it, like, you can do it in your gym. We can use the equipment you have. We can absolutely do more than odds are you're going to do by going to any clinic.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that. That's why we're working together. And apologies to anybody who feels my nomenclature was not specific enough dumb doctors, you know, like, you know, what one of the most frustrating things was during my medical training is that generally when doing strength tests, right? Like I said, they call it power. And I'm like, it's not really power, really. It's strength is real. You're really testing. If there's some sort of time component, you know, velocity thing, you know, whatever. Yeah, well, let's call it power, but strength, it's different. They're different. They're different guys. And they're like, whatever, nerd. We'll call it power if we want.
Well, but this gets into, you know, I don't want to open this because we're wrapping it up, but what is strength and how are we testing it? And there's some great papers that looked at like isometric testing at different joint angles, and we try and standardize it, but to expect the athlete to give you the same force at one joint angle versus another, that's not how it's played out in literature, which also means that as a rehab specialist, we need to know how to properly test if we're going to compare that to normal.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, excellent job on the mystery case. You get a gold star. You got it immediately. So I think the, you know, bilateral quad tendon rupture, you can diagnose with a mask on, apparently. Special shout out to Dr. Derek Miles for joining me here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning. If you have an issue, an ACL repair, sorry, if you have an issue, if you have an ACL reconstruction or other question about that, you can send us an email at support@barbellmedicine.com. But before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hey everyone, Jordan here from Barbell Medicine. Now we'll get to the podcast here in just a moment, but I wanted to take a second to plug our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, if you hate these ads just as much as we do, you should know that Plus members get ad-free episodes, as well as early access to our podcast, written episode summaries, videos, exclusive training information, access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing here and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus to help us out and get rid of these ads for good. Thanks for your support. Let's head to the podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.